supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb. Our show today takes a look at the inner critic. We all have one. It's the voice that tells us you've got to try harder. It's the voice that says you have to do more. Sometimes it acts like a much-needed motivator, but all too often it can become a degrading and abusive voice that follows us everywhere. So what do we do about it? How can we tame this voice? Here to talk with us about that nagging inner critic today are Drs. Kristen Neff and Beth Weinstock. Kristen Neff is an associate professor in the Educational Psychology Department at the University of Austin in Texas, and is inspired and well-known for her work in insight meditation and self-compassion. Kristen, welcome.
Thank you, Gita. Thanks for having me. I hope Dan's okay.
Yes, I think he's on his way to right back on track.
Great.
Beth Weinstock is a psychologist and a leadership coach. She's a co-founder of the Resilience Group in Philadelphia. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So I know a lot of people who make a mistake and then they kick themselves in the rear end for it for a couple of days, maybe even a week. But then, even in criticizing themselves, they criticize themselves for criticizing themselves. It sounds actually like me. And what do you say to these people?
Well,
I was confused who you're
asking. Oh, yeah. Let's start with you, Kristen.
Oh, well, I mean, as you mentioned in your introduction, self-criticism, the term is kind of vague. It could theoretically mean constructive criticism, ways in which we point out behaviors that aren't very helpful or skillful that we want to change. But typically, criticism takes a much more harsh tone. The emotional tone is mean, quite frankly, and tends to categorize us as bad as opposed to saying a particular behavior perhaps is unskillful. So that type of criticism, we know through the research, really is antithetical to motivation, makes us feel depressed, makes us lose faith in ourselves, and ultimately we're pulling the rug out from underneath ourselves when we adopt this approach. So there is a better way.
Wow. You know, because many people, myself included, previously thought that this inner critic was really good motivation and, you know, that's what kept me going. And you're saying that it's actually the opposite way.
Yeah, the research is pretty strong at this point, showing that's the case. So you might get some short-term boost from harsh self-criticism. You know, it'll get you to the gym, for instance, or it'll get you to study for that test. But the problem is it has lots of long-term consequences. For instance, depression is very strongly linked to self-criticism, and you know, depression is not exactly a get-up-and-go mindset for achieving your goals. It's also strongly linked to fear of failure. So if you know that if you try and you fail, you'll be met with a barrage of self-criticism, well, then it's easier not to even try. You also lose faith in yourself over time. And we know in the motivation literature that one of the most important factors for predicting whether or not you achieve your goals is your belief in your own ability, your perceived competence. So there's many ways and reasons why self-criticism doesn't work, and yet being kind, supportive, like a good coach, like a good parent, like a good friend, these are ways to help you make a change that are actually productive and supportive, not unproductive.
So, Beth, I'm going to go to you. Who is this inner critic that's giving us such a hard time, and what do they want from us?
Well, the inner critic so often was born inside of us in early childhood when we were incredibly dependent on our caretakers and parents. And if for any reason our parents and caretakers weren't able to meet our needs, we decided that it was our fault. Must be something about me. I must not be good enough, because if I were, then I'd be getting my needs met. So, for example, if I have a depressed parent and I can't get them not depressed, I decide that it's my fault. Because I just don't have, as a child, the ability to know that parents have very complicated lives and don't always know how to meet our needs. But if I decide that it's my fault, then maybe I can do something about it, and I start noticing what I'm doing, telling myself I'm doing it wrong, and try and correct myself. But as Kristen said, that negative feedback to ourselves is never what we really need.
I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation about the inner critic. What is your inner critic saying? Does it sound like someone you know or someone you're related to? Our number is 888-477-9499. So, Kristen, what can be done with small children when they begin this process?
By the way, I just have to give my appreciation to Beth for bringing up this point about the fact that our inner critic often is internalized. And that we actually internalize the inner critic for loving reasons, that we wanted to help ourselves. And so underlying the voice of the inner critic is this deep desire for us to be well and happy that we had as children. So, you know, when you talked about criticizing yourself for criticizing yourself, in fact, if you have compassion for the inner critic, understand where it comes from, understand what it's trying to do, that's a really important way that we can transform our relationship to it. In terms of actual childhood, how to work with that, you know, I guess it depends. Are you talking from the point of a parent or a therapist?
Let's talk about it from the point of a therapist. Like, what would you go in? How would you intervene? How would you teach them?
I'm not a therapist, Beth. Are you?
Yes.
I'll pass that one over.
Yeah. Well, I think the same way a parent would help a child is the same way any of us help ourselves, which is to be learning to coach ourselves. And I'm so glad Kristen used the word to be a good coach to ourselves. We have to learn how to hear what's being said and stop it and interrupt it when it's coming from a negative self-talk place. So if we have a child that tends to be very self-critical, hopefully we're able to say, hey, wait a minute, you know what, let's just think about that for a second. Actually, you're really not whatever that is that the child is thinking that they're negative about. You know, you're really good at this, and I love this quality about you, and you're not being very reasonable about who you really are. So we need to look with fresh eyes at what's so and what's not so. Hopefully, as parents, we help children do that. And then as adults, we need to be doing that with ourselves. We need to raise our awareness of the critical messages that we send ourselves. Then we need to say to ourselves that we have to stop once we hear what we're saying to ourselves, and then come in with a different kind of self-message that would be, as Kristen would say, self-compassionate, nurturing, realistic, and neutral. That's corrective. We need to send ourselves corrective messages to our inner critical messages.
Okay, so let's take it step by step then. Let's say...
Sure.
You're working with a child and they say, I'm no good at baseball. I stink at baseball. I shouldn't have played baseball.
And those are two different things. There's I'm not good at baseball, which may be true for a particular child,
sure.
In which case there's, you know what, you're not the best at baseball. You're awfully good at playing the piano. You're very good at a lot of things, and none of us are good at everything. So part of life is accepting that we're very good at some things and we're lesser good at other things.
Okay. Kristen.
Oh, I just have to throw in a story here, which
sure.
is a little tangential, but my son, out of the mouth of a babe, I was actually, my son was the one who gave me this lesson, a similar lesson the other day. We were driving in the car listening to the radio, and I was singing along, and I said to my son, I'm such a terrible singer. And he said, Mom, you aren't a terrible singer. You just sing terribly. You know, so kind of the idea that, just because you don't do a particular behavior that well doesn't mean you are a bad person. And it's just catching this process of generalizing your performance in a particular area to your overall worth as a person. And parents can do a lot of work with their kids early on to stop that process from happening. you know, maybe you really aren't good at baseball. So as Beth says, that's okay. There's other things you're good at. You know, parents have to be really careful with this issue of contingent self-esteem. Most kids, their sense of self-worth depends on success in certain areas of life. And usually that's looks, popularity, and other types of successful performance. So if parents only give praise to their kids or support to their kids when their kids succeed, you could be setting your kid up for failure in the long term. So this kind of unconditional message, it's okay if you fail, it's okay if you're good at some things, not others, is really what's going to benefit the kid in the long run.
Right.
I wanted to underline the word generalization that Kristen said, because one of the things about our inner critic is that it tends to think like a child. It thinks we're good or we're bad, you know, that we're fat or we're thin, that we're smarter, we're stupid. And one of the ways that we need to talk to children, but also to ourselves as adults, is to not be making those generalizations, to not be making black and white kind of thinking, because the reality is that most of us, the truth is rarely black and white about anything.
Sure, sure, absolutely. So what do you think about the difference between self-esteem and, I mean, the space between self-esteem and self-compassion?
Kristen's domain. Take it, Kristen.
I've talked a lot about that just because there has been such a strong, really, backlash against the self-esteem movement in psychology. And by the way, I should be very clear, we can use the word self-esteem in a variety of ways. But the type of self-esteem that I believe is problematic is really positive judgments of self-worth. In other words, I am a good person. And the problem with that type of self-esteem is that it's, first of all, based on social comparison. You have to be special and above average to be a good person in our society. I mean, if I said, Gita, you know, your skills as an interviewer, average. You'd be like, oh, my God, you know, you'd be so upset. It's not okay to be average. So that's the problem. Our self-esteem is predicated on the social comparison. And like you said, it also tends to be contingent. It's a fair-weather friend. It's there for us when we succeed. And it deserts us when we fail, which is exactly when we need it most. So I really see self-compassion as not a way of evaluating yourself positively or negatively. It's simply a way of relating to yourself kindly. So when you succeed or when you fail, you know, when you reach your goals or you make a terrible mistake, you can still relate to yourself kindly with a sense of kindness, connectedness, presence, by doing so, you have a positive relationship with yourself that isn't dependent on judgment. And that steps in precisely when you need it most, and that's when you fail or you're really struggling. So a lot of research now, again, supports that self-compassion is a much more stable and, you might say, emotionally healthy way of relating to ourselves and self-esteem.
Okay. I just want to remind our listeners that they can join the conversation. We're talking about inner critics and how do they affect your life. Have you figured out a way to tone them down? Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb. Let's go to a caller. Keith, you're on the line.
Hey, can you hear me?
Hi, yes.
Hey, I just want to ask, you know, I have a lot of things that resurface in my thoughts, and I kind of, you know, I try to forgive myself for them, and I tell myself, like, hey, you know, that was, like, years and years ago, and you're totally different now, but they kind of, you know, they just keep coming back, and I was wondering if there was, like, any way, like, a nice way to forgive myself or something, you know?
Beth?
Yeah, well, the good news is that you're reminding yourself that whatever that was happened a long time ago. And it may be that if the negative self-talk continues and continues, that it's helpful to get some counseling about what else that you could be doing. It's really important to stay with this business of self-compassion that Kristen's talking about, that in a full life, there are things that we've done that we regret. And we need to be accepting of that part of our humanity. And that forgiveness is a part of self-compassion, that in learning to love ourselves and accept ourselves, that goes with accepting the things we wish we hadn't done. It goes with accepting parts of ourselves that we wish we hadn't had. Now, it may also be that your mind keeps kind of spitting out the negative self-talk about those things in the past. And what we have found is that actually the brain can change if we stay very persistent in interrupting the negative thinking. So I like that you're already on that track, and I'd say stay with that, that you need to keep saying, yes, it was a long time ago, that was then, this is now, I can move forward now. That was then, this is now, I can move forward now.
Great.
Yeah, and I'll just want to add something to that, which is, you know, everything that I said was really wonderful. And another thing that I find is really, really helpful because, you know, sometimes, let's face it, especially when we have a very strong, recurrent negative thought, it's very hard to interrupt it. And especially in those cases where it seems very difficult, I find it's useful to give compassion to where you are now. So in other words, it's painful to have this negative thought that you would really like to let go of, you would really like to forgive yourself, you would like to be free of the suffering of hearing this over and over again, and you're having a hard time doing that. And you can actually start there. Start with acknowledging and validating the suffering entailed by having this negative thought that you can't seem to get rid of, and give that compassion. Then everything starts to loosen up. Right, so it's really starting at the outermost layer of suffering, you might say, the thing that's right now in this moment giving you some distress. Give compassion for that, and then maybe everything will loosen to the point we can actually start touching the deeper negative thoughts and feelings driving the whole cycle. If that made sense.
Keith, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
All right, well, we've got to go to break, and I'm going to give out our number again because we'd love to hear from you. It's 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you'd like to weigh in on how you feel about your inner critic. What does it say to you? What do you say back to it? I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, George Takei of Star Trek fame has a new documentary about his life. He was five when his family was sent to a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II.
There were tall sentry towers with machine guns pointed at us. When I made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed me.
Takei will also talk about coming out as gay at age 68. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And we're back. You're listening to Voices in the Family, and I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the inner critic, and we've got a lot of phone calls. Let's go straight to the lines. We've got George. George?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, yes.
Oh. Yeah, I feel like a lot of guilt and everything, and you're saying that the best way to do it is just forgive yourself. Is there an outside person that does that? Do you go to confessional, or... Is it you recommend a confessional, or have to be a therapist? Or?
Beth?
Oh, I think there are many ways to forgive ourselves, and I'm going to refer to what Kristen said, which is that we start with saying to ourselves, it's really too bad that I'm suffering with this. I'm hurting. I'm in pain about this.
Yeah, I was like, what if your whole life, you just found out that you didn't believe in really what your whole life stood, you know, what's happening with our so-called American dream and our so-called American way of life. It's all been a farce, and you feel a lot of guilt for being deceived by it. And, like, you know, how I invested a 401k, and it's really making somebody else suffer in a third-world country. And it really is not benefiting anybody but a few like myself that are rich enough to invest in other people's lives and we're just living off of other people. Does the guilt build up to where, I blame myself, but I blame the system, I blame everybody? What do we do about living off the suffering of other people?
Right.
How do you get along with
it? Right. Kristen, can you speak to that?
Well, obviously, the world is incredibly complex, and it's so such a wonderful thing getting to the point where we really start to look, how are my actions impacting others, as well as how their actions are impacting me. And so I really see compassion and forgiveness as a needing to include ourselves, but also include other people. So in other words, if we want to live a compassionate, open-hearted life, part of that would be thinking about how do my investments, for instance, impact other people, but also having compassion for ourselves, understanding that we're doing the best we can. We can't ever do everything absolutely right the whole time, even though we might. The pain of, as this gentleman said, sometimes we realize we've been living our life a certain way and it's meant something completely different than what we thought it did. The human experience is difficult. The beauty of the human experience, though, is that we can hold all of it in compassion. We can hold all of it in wisdom and an open heart. And when we're in that place of, you might say, wise, open-heartedness, compassion, care, we're able to make decisions that are more clear-sighted and hopefully will benefit, other people as well as ourselves in the long run.
That's great. We've got another call. Can we go to Sean?
Hello. I just wanted to say, I think in my own personal life, I have difficulty vacillating between sort of like self-aggrandizement. When I do something well, I think, God, I'm the best guy going. And then I seem to transition very rapidly into rather biting self-criticism. And I have difficulty finding that happy medium where I can incorporate useful self-criticism and at the same time be positive about myself without running the risk of that kind of aggrandizement or arrogance. And I was wondering if you guys had any tips or strategies on how to balance that.
Well, the good news, again, is that you have awareness that that's what you tend to do. So I would be starting with that every time you notice and to keep noticing, oh, I'm doing that aggrandizing thing again, or every time you're being very hard on yourself, that you're noticing, there I am again being really hard on myself. But if you can develop the part of your mind that keeps noticing, that keeps witnessing what you do, you may begin to find that you're balancing some of that out, or that you don't totally believe in the aggrandizement when you're going in that direction, or the self-criticism when you're going in the other direction. Because if we develop an internal witness, a side of ourselves that keeps noticing what we're doing, that part of ourselves that's noticing begins to help us balance things out.
And Kristen, do you have anything to say for
Sean? Maybe I would just add that in a way what's happening, what you're describing, is what I would call the self-esteem trap. We want to feel the best. We want to feel like we're number one. We get a lot of social reinforcement for this. And of course, it's not bad to want to be number one or to want to be special and above average. What could be more natural? The only problem is that it puts us in this position of either feeling we're better than others, we're great, or we're worse than others, we're terrible. So what self-compassion is, it's just another option. It completely leaves this positive versus negative evaluation thing out of the picture and just focuses on being kind, supportive, caring toward ourselves, both when we succeed and when we fail. So maybe it's just the wrong question. The question is not how good am I? The question is, can I be kind to myself exactly as I am? And, try walking down that path and see where it takes you. It'll take you to quite a different place.
Thank you, Sean, for calling in. I want to remind our listeners that we're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb, and we're talking to Drs. Kristen Neff and Beth Weinstock. Kristen Neff is an associate professor in the Educational Psychology Department at the University of Austin in Texas, and she specializes in self-compassion. Beth Weinstock is a psychologist and a leadership coach and the co-founder of the Resilience Group in Philadelphia. Kristen, I wanted to talk to you again about self-compassion. As I was having a conversation with colleagues earlier, someone was saying it's so hard to tell the difference between self-compassion and self-indulgence, and that they often feel like if they are being nice to themselves, that they are pitying themselves. Is that something you've heard before?
Oh, yeah, that's a very common misconception. There's actually three that you talked about. There's self-pity and self-indulgence, and self-compassion is neither of those. So the difference between self-pity and self-compassion is a very clear one, in that self-pity is poor me, woe is me. It's very self-focused. Self-compassion always remembers that the shared human experience is one of imperfection. So it's not poor me. It's saying, wow, life is difficult for all of us. The human experience itself entails suffering. So it's a very connected emotion, and it's not self-focused at all. The self-indulgence one, it is true. Sometimes it's hard to tell, and actually sometimes you can't tell from the outside. So what is self-indulgence? The term really means you're giving yourself pleasure, short-term pleasure, at the expense of long-term harm. So a mother who's indulgent to her child lets her child eat all the sweets he wants because, oh, it'll make little Johnny so happy, right? But that's not a compassionate mother, because little Johnny's going to get a stomach ache and throw up and who knows what else.
Yeah.
So a compassionate mother says to little Johnny, Johnny, I love you. You can't eat that candy. You got to eat your vegetables. You know, you got to get some exercise, because she cares about his health and well-being. So in order to find the difference between are you being self-indulgent or self-compassionate, all you have to ask yourself is the key question. Is this behavior or action or whatever I'm doing, is this good for my health and well-being in the long run? Or is it bad for my health and well-being in the long run? And the answer will tell you if it's self-compassion or self-indulgence. Self-compassion always chooses health over short-term pleasure.
You know, when you're talking about self-compassion, as I was reading your work, I realized that I found myself thinking that I was embarrassed that maybe that self-compassion was some sort of corny idea, and then I thought, why would I be embarrassed to be nice to myself? And can you help me out with that, Beth, Kristen?
Yeah, you know, I think we are all very ready to be self-critical and think that we're going to learn from being self-critical. We put a focus on negativity over positivity. And I think part of what you're talking about, Gita, is that we're not accustomed to being more self-positive. We're very accustomed to being self-negative. You know, we grow up learning what we're doing wrong more than we learn what we're doing right. And our internal speak, our internal voices tend to want us to pay attention to the negative things or what we think are negative rather than the positive.
And you know, for me, a huge motivation to get over that and start working on confronting this inner critic and is that I don't want to pass it on to my children, because I remember hearing my own mom saying negative things to herself out loud, and now sometimes, like, I have heard myself say that, and I thought, I don't want to pass this virus on to my kids.
That's such a good point, Gita. A lot of parents ask me, well, how can I teach my child to be more self-compassionate? And the number one way is to model self-compassion for your children. You know, a lot of parents are very good. They would never say the types of things they say to themselves to their children. And yet, you know, certainly if you say it out loud in front of your child will internalize it. But even just, you know, children are very good at empathetically picking up on the emotional and mental mind state of their parents. And if that mind state is one of harsh self-criticism of negativity, the child will internalize that. But if the parents, through a process of being kind, caring, supportive, at peace with themselves, their mind state is one of kindness and peace, well, then the child will internalize that, too. So, you know, really the golden rule should be do unto yourself as you would do unto others. And the world would be a lot kinder place.
You know, I think we've got a caller, Alexander, who wants to ask us about something that's related to this. Alexander, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hi.
I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and I was listening, and you guys were talking about how, you know, young children develop their inner critic. My daughter is very, very aware of emotions, both herself and us, my wife and I. How do we help her, develop a healthy inner critic? I mean, it sounds like there's almost no way around, you know, avoiding the development of the inner critic, but how can we kind of help her, you know, develop that in a healthy way for herself?
Yeah, you know, I think that what we're talking about is how we help a child develop the voice of an inner coach. I don't know that the inner critic needs to be so fated to happen all of the time. If you and your wife are talking to each other in positive ways, then you're going to be doing the modeling that we've been talking about. And when you hear your child saying something about, I'm really bad at that, that's when you step in and say, yeah, okay, well, let's look at the things that you're good at. Back to the messages we were talking about before, giving realistic messages that make it okay to be good at things, bad at things, fail at things, try at things, and be resilient. We're not going to get rid of the negative voices that we hear entirely, but we can begin to counteract them with the voice of an inner coach. And you can, when you hear your child saying anything that is self-negative, you can say, let's think of another way to say that. Can we say that differently? How would you want me to say that to you? What would feel good if I said something back to you about that, and begin to develop different kind of language.
I would second that. Language and also tone is so important. Sometimes you could say the exact same words, and it's the tone in which it's expressed. You know, why do children want to feel like they're good and not bad? Well, because underlying that is the need to be loved, to be accepted, to belong, to be safe. So as long as the tone and also the words convey the message you are lovable, you are wanted, you belong, you are safe, then the child might have the freedom to talk about, well, I could have done this better, or I could do that a slightly different way. But we really want to establish the emotional safety in the relationship with the child, both parent to child, and then ultimately in the child's relationship with themselves. They are lovable whether they succeed or fail.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Alexander, for calling in. We have got a caller named Keith on the line who has a great question about the role of family members.
Hello?
Hi, Keith. Welcome.
Yeah, hello. Actually, it relates kind of to what you were just talking about. I'm a teacher at a high-end private school, and my question is about, you know, what are the role of family members in developing our inner critic? As we hear time and time again, you know, I'm a teacher, but I'm also an academic advisor, and when the students get a mediocre grade, the first response out of their mouth normally is, oh, my mom is going to, you know, X, Y, Z, me, whatever, fill in your adjective of choice.
Right.
But we find over time and time again that actually isn't true. Really what they're speaking to is that they're disappointed in themselves, but maybe they're hearing, you know, mom in their inner hearing or something. So I wonder if you could comment on what the development or how the parent units help our inner critic.
Yeah, well, you have such an important job, and I'm glad that you're asking the question. One of the ways our inner critic, our harsh one, develops is, in fact, to hear critical things from our parents, and then we internalize that voice, and we begin to think things like, oh my God, my parents is going to X me or whatever. One of the things that you can do is talk to parents about the need for the child to feel accepted, loved, and valued regardless of what grade they get. And as an educator, perhaps to be talking about how important that is in general. We're living at a time when, unfortunately, the need to show that we are good through our good grades or our successes, as Kristen said, is a bit of an epidemic. And I think it's important for all of us who are in this field, you included, working with parents, to be helping them understand the importance of having a wider lens, a wider frame for what is important in what their children are doing.
Thank you for calling, Keith. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to go to a quick break. I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family on WHYY FM.
Good Shepherd Pen Partners supports WHYY. The specialty hospital at Rittenhouse from Good Shepherd Pen Partners offers extended medical and nursing care for stable but complex patients. The care team is experienced in weaning patients off of ventilators and treating complex wounds, while patients receive varying levels of therapy that complement their ongoing medical care. Good Shepherd Pen Partners is the official therapy provider for Penn Medicine. Details at PennPartners.org or 877-969-7342.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After a lifetime of making romantic comedies like When Harry Met Sally or his latest And So It Goes, what has Rob Reiner learned about relationships?
What I've discovered is that women are just more evolved than men.
Rob Reiner on The Ways of the Heart, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Gita Simons in for Dan Gottlieb, and we're talking about the inner critic. Our guests are Dr. Kristen Neff, who's an associate professor in the Educational Psychology Department at the University of Texas in Austin and is a specialist in self-compassion. We also have Dr. Beth Weinstock, who is a psychologist, leadership coach, and she's the co-founder of the Resilience Group in Philadelphia. Welcome back. I also want to give our guests the invitation to call us. We have a few lines open at 1-888-477-9499 and call us in and tell us, have you figured out how to deal with your inner critic? Do you need some help dealing with your inner critic? And what does it say to you? So, Kristen, I've heard you say that this inner critic can be doing more damage to us than we think because many times we're not in tune with the pain that it causes us.
Yes. So oftentimes the inner critic is, the voice is very habitual. We don't even notice it. It's just kind of quiet background noise, or it might even be a felt sense as opposed to explicit language saying, you know, you are bad, you are horrible. But it's this negative, really harsh emotional tone that can pervade our consciousness. So we really need to bring awareness and ask the question, am I, you know, maybe even just subtly judging myself here? And if so, what's the effect of that on me? Really importantly, and I don't know if I've made this point strongly enough, so I'm going to take this opportunity. The number one most important thing in dealing with your inner critic is to have compassion for it. We need to understand that the inner critic developed and operates as a way to keep it safe, keep us safe. It's saying there's some danger, you know, if you gain those pounds, you'll be rejected, or if you fail at work, you know, this terrible thing will happen to your family. The inner critic is constantly on the lookout for danger, and it's got a two-year-old way of dealing with that danger, which is by, you know, trying to fight the problem by beating ourselves up. But you need to understand that the inner critic, and in its own way, cares about us and is trying to help us. And therefore, if we have compassion for the inner critic, if we understand it, if we actually listen, how is it trying to keep me safe? How is it trying to help me? Then we can hear the message of the inner critic and give ourselves the same message in a much more productive fashion, and that's a compassionate one. If you fight the inner critic directly, you're just, you know, adding self-criticism onto self-criticism.
I want to add to what Kristen's saying, because she's right that this is such an important point. The irony is that our inner critic developed initially to guide us. When I said before, if I had a depressed mother and I'm not able to make her feel better and I start criticizing myself, the criticism is really for me to try and figure out what it is that I could be doing differently. The inner critic is trying to figure out what in the environment needs to, what I need to do differently in the environment, but it does it from a critical point of view. Its intent is to help us, but we begin to believe that it's the guide, that it's the guide to what will make the world better for us. And that's when Kristen was saying before that it's really, research tells us it's not a good motivator. But part of what's so hard about dealing with the inner critic is that we've come to believe that if I didn't listen to it, I'd be really in bad shape. If I didn't listen to my critic, I'd be a sloth. I'd never get off the couch. So part of working with the inner critic is to begin to dismantle that belief that it's actually not so. And I love that Kristen has all the research that tells us that the important truth of that.
Absolutely. This is a topic that resonates with so many people, and we've got a lot of calls. So I want to go right back to the lines. And we've got Carla. Carla, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm an artist, and I have the inner, whenever I'm working on my art, I have the inner critic at my elbow continuously. I don't make a mark without my inner critic saying, don't do this, don't do that. And it's because it's the old voices of my teachers, it's the voices, well, very often there's a lot of negative criticism in art instruction, and sometimes it's my peers, what I'm afraid of what my peers will say. One of my biggest fears is that I'm going to be disappointed in all of the effort I put into this work, and that's my inner critic, and I would like to be able to work free of that guy. And do you have any ideas?
Well, I don't know that you're going to work free of the guy, but I do think it's important to start talking back to that inner critic and saying, you know what, you're really getting in the way of my creative juices. You're really not being helpful. I know you're trying to be helpful, but you're not. What about you just step aside for a while and let me do this painting? You just step aside, and then we'll reevaluate later. But really, you're being an inhibiting voice at the moment. And I'd like to just experiment with having you step aside for a while, and I'm going to do my art. You're not going to get rid of it, but you hopefully can diminish its impact. And if, in fact, you can be self-compassionate that you're suffering with this voice, it may also help you diminish that voice. We're not going to fight the inner critic. We're not going to do away with it. We can learn to talk back to it. We can be self-compassionate that we have the suffering that it creates in the first place, and I think we do need to do that. And over time, we can change the habitual patterns that Kristen was talking about. Your inner critic is with you when you're painting, in part because that's a habit. You walk into the office, and your critic is there. You walk towards your canvas, your critic is there. Some of this is habit, and we need to begin to break the habit, and we can do it. You know, the new neuroscience is telling us that we can change our brain over time if we're persistent in working towards more positive self-coaching.
Carla, thank you so much. I hope that answered your question. I'm going to go straight to Susan. Susan, are you there?
Hi, yes, it's Susan. My question is, what do you do when your inner critic begins to criticize those around you, like, you know, the voice in your mind? You know, it could sort of, you get exhausted, and I think, and it kind of jumps from you onto people that you're intimate with.
What a familiar situation.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, the research shows that people who are more self-compassionate make better relationship partners because they aren't so critical of their partners. They aren't expecting their partners to meet all their needs exactly as they want them met, exactly when they want them met, right? When you can give a lot of that support and care to yourself, you aren't so dependent on your partner being perfect, and you can be less critical of them. So, I mean, I think it's a really important sign, and again, you know, wonderful, that type of awareness of that subtle process that's happening when you start getting depleted through your own self-criticism, you kind of try to spread the love, spread the self-critical love to other people. So being aware of that and seeing that as a sign that, hey, I'm probably not meeting my own needs in some way. What are my needs right now that aren't being met? Do I not feel connected enough? Do I not have enough peace in my life? Do I not feel appreciated enough? Do I not feel validated enough? Really asking, what do I need? And then seeing if there's some way you can actually give that to yourself because the people in your life at that moment may or may not have the resources to give you what you'd ideally need from them. Try giving it to yourself to the extent you can. You can actually give yourself a remarkable amount of appreciation, care, respect, love, support, and perhaps that will, you know, give you a few more emotional resources to have more productive relationships with others.
Susan, thank you for calling in. So, Beth, we have a caller that wants to ask this, and I'm so curious about this as well. How do we begin to even develop that self-awareness? How do we begin to hear that that's actually our inner critic talking to us and not the voice of reason?
That's a great question, because if we are used to our inner critic and habituated to it, as Kristen said before, we're not even hearing it anymore. It's a little bit like taping something to watch on television later and not knowing that the tape is running. We tend to be so habituated that it's as if the inner critic is kind of whispering in our ear, you know, I'm not good at this and I'm not very good at that and you shouldn't do this and you better be worried about that. We don't even hear it if we are habituated to it. So we've got to turn up the volume. It's not pleasant, but we need to turn up the volume so we begin to listen to what it is that we're saying. And as Kristen so well pointed out, the tone of voice in which we're saying it to ourselves. So the first step in change is always turning up our awareness of what it is that we're doing, saying, and how we're treating ourselves. Once our awareness is raised, we have options. We have to go inside to hear ourselves. We have to sometimes slow down in order to hear ourselves.
Right.
But that really is the first step.
Mm. Right, certainly. Yeah.
Just adding to that, one of the sometimes there are markers, like if you're feeling a lot of physical stress or a lot of physical tension, or a lot of very difficult emotions, sometimes if you dig a little bit, and as Beth said, really turn that light inward, you'll notice that what's actually driving that physical or emotional tension and stress is this subtle layer of self-criticism. So the outside pain is often the external marker of what's going on inside.
Let's go to the calls. We've got Virginia on, and she has a great question that relates exactly to this. Virginia?
Yes, I had a question for you. You know, you're talking about forgiveness, and I think it's excellent self-forgiveness and self-compassion. But how exactly does one go about forgiving oneself? Are there steps that one takes? How do you do that?
Great question.
Oh, there are many different ways to do it, and it is a great question. Sometimes it involves talking to others about what it is that you're holding so harshly against yourself. Sometimes it's asking yourself, if this were not me, but one of my best friends that I love the most, would I be so harsh about this on that person? Sometimes it's speaking to somebody in our religious community, if we have faith and there's somebody who we trust to go to talk to about it. Sometimes it's reading self-help forgiveness books, and sometimes it may be talking to a therapist or a counselor. There's a lot. You can also start by reading Kristen's writings on self-compassion, because they really do lead towards forgiveness. The most important thing, I think, when it comes to forgiving myself, I need to remind myself that I'm human and that I'm not perfect, and that there are things I wish I hadn't done, things I wish I hadn't said, and that that's just part of living, and that I need to accept that and move on to the next piece. You know, what we find is that people who are very resilient in life are people who are able to move on from whatever it is that happened that wasn't perfect, that happened that they wish hadn't happened. And that's not meaning denying what happened, but being able to accept that something's in the past and to move forward. And again, if we're having trouble moving past something in the past, that's when we need professional help.
That's a very thoughtful answer that I think it's going to help a lot of us. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. This has been such a helpful show to so many people. Brenda, I'm going to ask you to chime in. Hello?
Yes. Yes, thank you for the program. I have a quick question. You talked about some core things that every child needs to hear, that they are lovable, that they're also in a safe environment, and that they are wanted. And that's part and parcel of what you can do when you bring in that compassionate self later. And my question is, if you did not receive that from your parents, and if, in fact, your family of origin harmed those core things, added to the distress, didn't give them to you and harmed you, how do you build them for yourself so you have some resources to pull from?
We just have a minute, so let's get
yeah,
to
well,
it.
Just to say that absolutely those children who weren't given those things that they should have rightly been given do have a more difficult time with self-compassion. In fact, the very systems designed to evoke care and tenderness and nurturing have often damaged. But the research shows that you actually can learn to start meeting these needs for yourself, and that self-compassion is a really good way of helping to deal with the pain and trauma of past difficulties in one's childhood. But it's a slow road, and for people who do have especially trauma histories, it's really recommended they go down the path of self-compassion with a professional, because it can be pretty scary and painful. But absolutely, the research shows it can be done.
I want to really thank you both, Kristen Neff and Beth Weinstock, who've been talking to us today on Voices in the Family about how to deal with our inner self-critic. Kristen Neff is an associate professor in the Educational Psychology Department at the University of Texas in Austin, and she's a specialist in self-compassion. Beth Weinstock is a psychologist and a leadership coach and the co-founder of the Resilience Group in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next week on Voices in the Family, a rebroadcast of how to take and receive feedback. To download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. Follow us on Twitter at Voices in the Fam. The engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Howes is the production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. I'm Gita Simons, the producer of the show, and I've been filling in today for our host, Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, everyone.